Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hey, what's happening, everybody? Happy Friday to all of you. Nice to be with you. It is Friday and there are more sports and Seth Payne. I have got an extra hop in my step. Because tonight is a double screen Friday. I'm going to have the Astros on one side. I'm going to have the Rockets on the other side. They both started about the same time. And I am very, very, very excited. How are you, my friend?
It's just it's an annual rite, is it not? Like,
yes.
Hey, last night in July, that's the night you watch your MLB team, your NBA team.
Right.
And you wait for your NFL team to report to camp officially and totally.
Amidst pandemic testing, right? Nothing
right,
says
right.
Americana quite like the first week of Major League Baseball in late July, a restart of the NBA season on July 30th, and your NFL team getting ready to have a no preseason game preseason because of a coronavirus.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And the same old, and sometimes it gets tiresome, same old debates, you know, Jordan versus LeBron. Should you bunt with the rules of having a runner on second
right.
extra innings? All that same old stuff that people have been arguing about.
It's a
forever.
Tradition like no other, really.
Yes.
It's what it is. Did you check out the NBA reopening of the season, the restart of the season last night?
I had to check in and out, and so I was I didn't get the full dose of what I wanted, but I want to say, I don't want to be a jerk here. I'm really, because I was happy with what I saw, but it wasn't quite what I expected. In my mind, I had built this thing up to where, the NBA is going to unveil some crazy stuff, like virtual reality, to where it actually feels like you're in this intense arena. And they did the streaming fans up above the coaching and the bench area.
Yep.
So it was a cool environment, but it still felt a little bit like somewhere between Las Vegas Summer League and an NBA preseason game. And yet you could tell guys were playing their asses off, so I like that part.
Yeah, I think overall your point is valid. Like, it looked different. There's no question about that. The virtual fan thing I thought was kind of cool. It at least added a little bit of life to what I thought was going to be a pretty lifeless arena. I mean, that's the thing about these baseball games. I'm enjoying the Astros being back. And I'm enjoying baseball, and it feels real. There's just no question about it. It having been gone for 4 months, it feels real. Like, these games feel intense. I am emotionally invested. But in baseball, the cardboard cutout fans are more of a gimmick than anything else. I thought the NBA did a really good job. I don't know how much of it was translating through if you were in that field house last night. But at least with the television product, it felt like there was way more zip in that building than I expected there to be. You know, between the ambient noise, the organ player and the music inside where they were, you know, bump, 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 and the fans, it worked. For me, it worked.
The biggest difference that Brandy noticed immediately, I couldn't put my finger on it, but she said the players look so small. And they do. It looked like college, right? Because without everything pressed down on the court, without that, just everything immediately surrounding the court there, the court looks bigger and the players look smaller. And that was a little bit of a letdown because I think it's part of the NBA is that feeling that it's just larger than life.
Yeah.
And I felt like I lost a little bit of the larger than life. Like, again, I'm not whining or complaining about it. These are just my observations. I was just happy to have basketball back. And I'll get the full dose of it tonight because, frankly, I don't give a damn about the Lakers or the Clippers or the Jazz. I just... I care about the Jazz. I wish I could have watched. I was checking in on Twitter, and I could see that Gobert is still America's most popular foreigner.
most popular. I found myself into it only because during those games I was thinking about the Rockets and playoff seeding and so forth. I was rooting for the Pelicans against the Jazz, A, because I hate the Jazz, and B, because the Rockets are in that same gaggle of teams that Utah is in, and I want the Rockets to stay out of that seven hole. My feeling was this, just in watching the product that was taking place in between the lines, is that you're right, the size of the court was a little unsettling. It gave the feel of a gym as opposed to an arena.
Yeah.
And I think the play reflected that, at least in the first game. I felt like the play was a little loose and kind of pickup-ish in the first game. Now, the second game, especially in the second half, felt like a real NBA game with the big swings. When Anthony Davis hit the couple of three-pointers to bring the Lakers back in the third quarter, that felt like something that was taking place in Staples Center. And then at the end of the game where you're going back and forth with some drama at the end of that game, Paul George maybe getting fouled on the final shot and an NBA referee possibly screwing that up, that felt real. It felt like the NBA was back, right? That maybe the Lakers were getting a call at the end of the game or a non-call at the end of the game. So the bottom line for me was all of it worked to the point where I'm really psyched for the Rockets tonight.
And I think if you look at where we are right now compared to where we were 4 months ago, and I can remember when we first started talking about whether the NBA could pull off a bubble, I was very skeptical because at that time, of course, we were thinking, wait a second, could they do a bubble with the entire league? You know,
yeah.
I'd almost forgotten that was ever even a consideration. When they lopped off half the league and turned it into just playoff eligible teams, it made a lot more sense. But I had a healthy amount of skepticism that this was ever going to work.
Yeah.
And now that the testing has come back way, way better than we thought, and we're seeing actual basketball there, I think by the time we roll into the playoffs in a couple weeks, the intensity will be there for me. Yeah. And especially, like I said, I'm just waiting to watch my team and
right.
see how it feels with the Rockets.
Right.
And just hope that, and I anticipate that the Rockets won't be quite as sloppy as seemingly every other superstar was yesterday.
I found out that I missed Kevin Harlan, but I didn't miss Reggie Miller quite as much. I learned that last night.
Reggie Miller games. Is not one of those, hey, separation makes the heart grow
not even one
something.
Bit.
No, there was none of that. There was a little bit maybe when I was watching the Jordan documentary where I thought, sometimes I got to remember with Reggie Miller, A, man, he was a hell of a basketball player. B, he's a really smart basketball player.
Yeah.
But why does he not translate that intelligence to actually talking about the game when he's
incredible.
On the
side?
It's the strangest thing.
Yeah.
He might have the biggest gap between his actual intelligence and how he sounds when talking about his chosen sport than any other player commentator out there.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah, he was a killer, man. There's no doubt about that. Seth and I are off and running here on a Friday, just kind of chopping up some of the things we saw last night. I think there's a chance, one of my takeaways last night, Seth, was some of the guys look kind of rusty. Like LeBron looked rusty. There's no doubt about that. Anthony Davis had some spurts in the game, but he had other spurts in the game where he struggled a little bit. In the first game, I think, Brandon Ingram's probably as long as Zion's only getting 15 minutes a game, Ingram is their star. He was 7 of 20 last night. If what we saw from Harden in those scrimmages and what we saw in his workouts is something that applies to what we're going to see tonight, I think there's a chance that James Harden might be the least rusty star out of all these guys. Like, James Harden has a chance to really kind of he's not going to win the MVP or anything like that, but I'm kind of excited for these eight games to see what he looks like.
And just to see what this offense looks like.
Yeah.
You know, we've got a hell of an offensive matchup tonight, and I know that the biggest concern is what is the defense and what is the rebounding going to look like. Mm-hmm. Sean, I choose to focus on the positive as I've gone on a binge of, you know, various self-help book reading over the last 3 months.
Right, what's that?
I'm going to focus on just, okay, look, yeah, yes, they're tiny. Yes, they're going to get crushed on the boards at times. Yes, they have a tendency to not want to even try to get back on defense. But let's just enjoy the offense here,
right.
Okay? I don't care if they get – look, Sean – they make the finals and they get swept like with every game ending 148 to 143. I'm okay with
entertaining.
It,
you know? Yeah.
Yeah.
In some ways, Seth, I'm kind of glad that the first Rocket game is taking place on a Friday because there's a good chance I'll be drunk and I think I'll be able to deal with some of those elements a little bit better.
Like the lack of defense. The scoreboard, Sean.
Yeah.
It's going to be some scoring up in here.
That's right. That's right. I'm drunk on points, baby. That's what I'm drunk on. All right. So Seth and I off and running here on a Friday. Mark Vandermeer joins us in the 8 o'clock hour. A lot of stuff to get into with Mark. We mentioned the basketball in the Open. We've got baseball tonight as well. An early meaningful series where I think we're going to learn a lot about the Astros more than anything else that's happened in the first week of the season. And if we get extra innings again, I can't wait to see the world burn down on Monday. We'll talk about it next. Astros Angels this weekend. I said, Seth, yesterday that, you know, the Astros spent the first four games of the season playing what I feel might be the worst team in the American League. They spent the last two games playing the team that might be the best team in baseball. So I think we've learned some things early on here about the Astros. I think the rookies on this pitching staff have been a nice, pleasant surprise. 1.38 ERA for the nine rookie pitchers through the first six games of the season. So,
goodness.
Again, small sample size, but it is, as you pointed out yesterday, 10% of the season is gone.
Yeah, I know, yes.
So,
if there ever was a year to have to rely on your rookies, what better year than when the rest of the league only has so much time to actually see them? Including, think about that series, a two-game series.
Yeah.
So they don't, even the Dodgers themselves, don't get to get a second look at some of these relievers or anything. It's not bad.
It's not bad.
That part of it's lining up all right.
This will be a series, I think, where we learn a lot about the Astros because, A, they're coming off of a two-game sweep at the hands of the Dodgers. B, this is what, at least from a manpower standpoint, we'll call it, is probably most what the Astros are going to resemble if Justin Verlander is out for the year. McCullers is going to start the first game of this series. Greinke is going to start the second game of this series. And then we just hope and pray at the things that happen after those two guys right now. The way the staff is lined up, that's normal. They're coming off an off day, so presumably everybody in the bullpen is available. That's a good thing. And at some point here, these guys, specifically Springer, Altuve, and Bregman, who, Seth, I went and crunched the numbers yesterday.
Ooh.
The Springer, Altuve, Bregman trio, that's your top three hitters in the order, three guys who have garnered many an MVP vote over the last 3 years. Altuve, an MVP, an actual MVP award. Their combined OPS, that's on base plus slugging, is .583.
Oh, that's bad. For those of you at home that only care about batting average, usually like between 800 and 900 is about average for a major league. 800 is about, I think 800 is the midpoint.
Yeah.
So anything below 800, you're not doing well. And if you're down on the 500s, man, those are minor league. That's getting you sent back down to the minors if you weren't already a stud like those guys are.
I have a contextual comparison. Zach Greinke's career OPS as a hitter is 600. Now, Zach Greinke is one of the better hitting pitchers, but just kidding, you know. So you know that Springer, Altuve, and Bregman thus far this season have hit slightly below a very good hitting pitcher.
And I take that back. 710 is like the midpoint.
I was going to say 800 is pretty sporty.
Yeah. You see 800 and you're like, all right, you know, Sean, this is the problem, though. I've been spoiled by the Astros.
Yeah.
Honestly,
everybody's 800.
The Astros, and I'm like, you got an 800 OPS. You're all right.
Right.
You can be seventh or eighth in the lineup, maybe, and we'd be okay with it. Yeah.
You're Yuli. Yeah. 805. You're like Yuli. You're like a seven hole guy. You know. The guy that hit .310 with 30 bombs and 100 RBIs last year.
Yeah, just the guy.
Yeah. Right. So I think, Seth, looking at the series this weekend, that's, you know, the hope is, you know, McCullers does what he's been doing. Greinke gets a little bit of his groove back. And I think the biggest thing, if you and I are looking to come in on Monday, which, by the way, is another Astros off day. They've only got five of these during the year, and they're going to have burnt two of them by the time the first week of the season is over. My hope is that we're coming in on Monday saying, good, we can breathe a little bit easier because Springer, Altuve, and Bregman came through with guys on base, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, well, I'm a little torn over the fact that Major League Baseball basically allowed everybody in baseball to make the playoffs now, because it's I'm not as stressed out about any slow start as I would have once been.
Yeah.
And it, like I was kind of looking forward to that tension, but now I can actually say, okay, it's only a 60-game season, but these guys can withstand being in a slump for 10 or 20 games because it's going to come back around, and all they have to do is be in the top half. But it is there is still some urgency, way extra urgency than you would be in the seventh game of the season. Normally in the seventh game of the season, hey, Bregman's slumping, baby. That's just what he does.
Yeah,
hey,
yeah.
He'll come around. Now right. There's a whole lot extra urgency there.
Right, right. No, we're only 2.5% of the way through the season or something like that, as opposed to 10% of the season, whatever the numbers are. So it's I think my overall takeaway is I think this is a much more clarifying series for who the Astros are. Again, with the preface that all of this is within small little short bursts of a 60-game season. But a road series coming off a sweep of at the hands of the Dodgers, you got your horses lined up at the front of the rotation. You know, let's go win a series. You know, let's go 2-1 in this thing, and I'll feel good about them then going on to Arizona to take on the Diamondbacks. Seth, what did you think of what the Union did yesterday, or I guess at least is expected to do here shortly, which is announce that they're going to start on August 1st. Implementing double headers in which the games are 7-inning baseball games to try to get the schedule ramped back up for some of these teams. I mean, the Marlins and the Phillies are going to have gigantic big swaths of the schedule swept out by this coronavirus spread.
It's an inconvenient reality, but I think it's necessary at this point. And you think about how huge that is to only play a 7-inning game. I mean, that's 4 relievers that you're saving, at least, in one day. And how much that matters, especially given all the injuries that people have had so far, given the fact that you don't – with the Astros, think about how many rookie pitchers they're having to use. That's going to help the Astros out a whole lot. Yeah. And regardless of how much the Astros themselves have to do it, I'm okay with it. Like, there's not – does it make it more likely that people are going to make this World Series champion kind of an asterisk world champion? Perhaps, but what else are you going to do? Like, I would rather have 60 games played by every game team in the league, with some of them being 7-inning games, than to have some awkward, crooked, hey, this team played 60 games, but this team only played 52 games, but because they have a better winning percentage, they're actually seeded higher than the team that played 60 games.
Yeah, Seth, if you were to ask me so far, like, is the weirdness of the season negatively or positively affecting your enjoyment of baseball at all? And maybe my answer is colored with the fact that we were so thirsty for anything sports-wise. I'm cool with, like, they could put an alligator pit in the middle of center field as a gimmick and put clown mouths down the line. If the ball rolls down the line into the mouth of the clown, it's an automatic triple. They could do stupid stuff like that, and I'd probably be like, don't care, it's live sports, I don't have to watch Netflix anymore. But the weirdness that's been injected, other than the coronavirus hitting the Marlins and the Phillies, that's obviously unfortunate. But the things like the extra inning rule, this 7-inning doubleheader thing, just the weird ways in which you're having to use your pitching staff because of the season, I'm kind of enjoying this stuff. It feels different, and I think what it accentuates to me is maybe just how stale baseball was. Universal DH. I'm loving that we're playing these National League teams, and we don't have to worry about a pitcher hitting at some point.
This is almost like you're on vacation in Vegas.
Yes.
You know? Nobody ever has to know exactly what weird stuff you got into. Mm-hmm. It doesn't change who you are as a person.
Right.
You go back to being a deacon at the church, whatever it might be. But it's just that's what we're doing. We're in Vegas, baby.
What happens in 2020 stays in 2020.
Yeah. So I'm okay with it. This is what I'm dreading, though. It's that just like it is with the runner on second base, this is what happens in baseball, more so than in any other sport. A rule will be changed or something will be added that, in general, is going to make the game faster, but in any specific instance where it doesn't work, the sky is falling everybody.
Yeah.
Oh, you put, in this instance, a runner on second, you still had to go multiple extra innings. It's a failure of a rule, and the same thing's going to happen with the,
Seth, that is so funny you say that. I'm in the car yesterday, and I'm listening, and whoever I was listening to, I think, was talking about the – I can't remember if it was In the Loop or if it was Clinton's show. They were talking about the extra innings and the Astros going 13 innings, and it got me thinking about the goal of the putting the runner on second base is to shorten the game, right? And yeah. and I don't know if it was one of them on their shows or if it just reminded me of something I'd heard earlier in the day or seen on Twitter where I saw somebody saying, well, the goal of this was to shorten the game. Astros went 13 innings. It's like, yeah, and they're the only one so far to go beyond the 11th. Like, yeah, just because it's not working 100% of the time doesn't mean that it's not working. Like, all of the other times, it's achieved its desired goal, which is to get these teams the hell off the field by the 11th inning.
It's a pet peeve of mine because in baseball, there's always the effort to shorten the games, you know? And this is what Major League Baseball do. They'll come up and they'll say, hey, look, we want to make this rule change that will, on average, shave 45 seconds off the time of an average game. And the immediate response is, huh, well, that's not going to take half an hour off the game. Like, yeah, I know that's what we're saying. Like, this is one small incremental. Yeah, but, all right, I give up.
Your impersonation.
You want to know why Manfred has gotten so stupid progressively? It's because every time he tries to do anything at all, people are like, well, that's not going to cure every ill in the world.
No, he's trying to please that guy that you're impersonating. Right now, that's why. Like your impersonation of indignant fan is very underrated. I just want you to know that.
Sir, we know you've got cancer, and there's about seven different things we have to do to cure the cancer. Here's the first one that we're going to do. Well, that alone isn't going to cure cancer. What the hell? Why bother?
Exactly what
one
it is.
Thing.
Oh yeah. My God! If you're Deshaun Watson.
Sorry, what were you saying about my impersonation?
Your impersonation of indignant fan, the voice that you make when you do guy who's angry that everything's not cured. Very underrated.
Put yourself in the role of anybody that's trying to fix any problem. If you're a mechanic, like imagine if you were a mechanic and somebody brings in their car that's totaled, and you're like, okay, well, the first thing we have to do is we need to find out why all this oil is leaking. Well, what about the broken headlights?
Yeah, I love that. If you're Deshaun Watson, would you rather have the respect of your peers or opposing coaches? That's next. This is something that'll feel kind of normal as far as sports coming back. We get a Bill O'Brien and Jack Easterby press conference today at 11 o'clock. It's a Zoom conference call. It's not a in-person dealio, but 11 o'clock today, Bill O'Brien, shortly thereafter. They're advertising it as 11:30, so that means maybe we get a half hour of O'Brien. Jack Easterby after that. We will carry it live here on Sports Radio 610. So make a note, the first chance of training camp to hear from the head coach, the first chance, I believe, in a press conference setting for Jack Easterby. I think he's done some stuff on Texans radio, but I think this is the first go-round for Easterby with the virtually assembled media horde, peppering him with questions.
This feels almost like a bride and a groom walking out of the church for the first time.
A little bit.
Doesn't it? This is the first time we've seen these two as a married couple.
So is O'Brien going to be carrying Easterby in his arms onto the Zoom conference call?
I wish they would. After the Zoom, O'Brien's going to pick Easterby up.
Carry him over the threshold.
Carry him over the threshold to NRG. They'll both be wearing biohazard suits. And it'll be just like that scene in Naked Gun 3 1/3 or 2 1/2, whichever one it was, where what's the name of the white-haired guy?
Leslie Nielsen.
Leslie Nielsen and Priscilla Presley are practicing safe sex, so they're both wearing full-body
yes,
condoms.
Yes, yeah.
It's going to be O'Brien and Easterby entering the facility together.
Okay, that's a disturbing image.
They're not having actual sex. It's more like it's a career sex.
Career, right.
They're combining together. They're entwining their legs and using different positions to create life, which is the 2020 Texans.
They are together for better or worse, no doubt about that. So Seth, one of my favorite columns of the year is out. And Mike Sando, who used to cover the NFL for ESPN, now covers the NFL for The Athletic. He is the only one I see do this. And I think once he started doing it, it got so much success. My guess is people were like, oh, well, he's got that idea. Can't copy that because nobody copies anything these days. he does this deal where he gets 50 NFL coaches and talent evaluators. And he has them put the quarterbacks in the league into tiers tier one, tier two, tier three, and the tiers have very distinct characteristics. And we'll start with tier one because here's good news, Texan fans. The one quarterback to make the leap up into tier one who's never been there before is your starting quarterback, Deshaun Watson. And if you want to know what the categorization of a tier one quarterback is, know this. A tier one quarterback can carry his team each week. The team wins because of him. He expertly handles pure passing situations. He has no real holes in his game. The five quarterbacks in tier one in order, Seth, are Patrick Mahomes, Russell Wilson, who are both unanimous picks for tier one. There are five tiers overall. They were both picked for tier one by all 50 of the voters. Then third place was Aaron Rodgers, who had 46 tier one votes, four tier two. Fourth place, Drew Brees, 33 tier one votes, 17 tier two. And then Deshaun Watson is the final quarterback in tier one, 28 and 22. 28 tier one votes, 22 tier two votes. Pretty high praise for Deshaun Watson from some people who watch a lot of football around the league.
Yeah, and the cool thing about this was that it's not like any of the coaches, other than one. One coach had him ranked as a tier three quarterback, and Sando pressed him on it, and the coach basically said, well, you know what? I haven't actually like sat down and prepared for him in a couple years, which makes me think that he's either an NFC North coach who wouldn't have prepared for him yet, or let's see, who did they play in 2017?
NFC West, and the only NFC West team they played was Seattle.
Okay, maybe it was whoever it was.
Could you be clear? The only NFC West that Deshaun started against
that Deshaun played
was Seattle.
Against,
yeah, the Texans obviously played all of them, but the other three they played once Deshaun got injured.
So regardless of, we'll go after the show. We're going to spend 8 hours figuring out which coach
who it
this
is.
Was.
We'll go through all the staffs, the position.
That phoned
coaches.
In his vote, and then, right. But he revised it to a tier two because he sat down and watched a bunch of film, and he called up Sando and watched 50 plays with him to explain why he went to tier two. But I think even the coaches that voted him tier two, you can tell, okay, there's one or two little tweaks that'll loft him up into the tier one for them, and the other half just say he's a tier one guy already.
I think Deshaun's a tier one. I think he's one of the five best quarterbacks in the game. Seth, I want to get into what some of these coaches said about him here in just a second. But from your evaluation and what Sando uses as a description for a tier one quarterback, is there anything in these four bullet points that Deshaun comes at least brushes up against not passing the smell test on for you? In the four bullet points, I'll read them again. A tier one quarterback can carry his team each week. The team wins because of him. He expertly handles pure passing situations. He has no real holes in his game. Are there any of those four things where you go, I don't know, I'm not quite sure?
So number four is an interesting one because I don't know if there's any every quarterback has holes in his game at some level, right? You know, Tom Brady's not going to extend a play with his
Nobody's
feet.
Perfect.
That was right. But I guess are there any glaring holes? I think the biggest thing was the first bullet is does he give his team a chance to win every week?
Carry his team each week.
Each week. I think that was the big difference between Deshaun this year and perhaps some of the other tier one quarterbacks. And it's not that, look, every quarterback has bad games throughout a season. I think there were times this year where Deshaun was presented a puzzle that he couldn't quite fix.
Yeah.
You know, and it wasn't completely and totally his fault. But a lot of times, I would say in the first half of the Buffalo game, I would say in the Carolina game, there were things that defenses did that flummoxed Deshaun, and he didn't quite have an answer for it. What Deshaun did was, like, in the Buffalo game, he learned, and in the second half, it was a whole different deal. After the Carolina game, he came back, he learned his lesson, he was getting rid of the ball quickly, he wasn't seeing ghosts in the secondary level of coverages. He learned from all of those things, and I think over the course of the season, what happened is, after that Carolina game, I would have said, you know what, he's still a tier two quarterback.
Yeah.
Then I saw him make those improvements. And then after the first half of the Buffalo game, I was thinking, all right, gosh, is he regressing a little bit? But the second half of the Buffalo game, he showed that, no, he had indeed like taken those lessons to heart. They figured some things out. I think Bill O'Brien tweaking how they were using DeAndre Hopkins in the second half made a big difference. And, yeah, I think that vaulted him up. That Buffalo game, for a lot of people, I think, not just here in Houston, that Buffalo game was something that your average quarterback or even your above-average quarterback just doesn't pull off.
Seth, I'm glad you said that. because I'm going to go through these quotes from some of these executives and coaches who did the, who were part of the 50 that did this evaluation for Mike Sando in this piece. And we're, if you're just tuning in, we're going through Mike Sando of The Athletic's annual piece where he puts all, he's got 35 quarterbacks in it this year. A few teams, there were two quarterbacks that he had them evaluate, Patriots, a couple of others. Deshaun Watson has moved into the first tier. He is the fifth-rated quarterback, and there are only five in the first tier. He's one of them. That Buffalo game, Seth, won a lot of people over. That Buffalo game seems to be playing a huge role in his evaluation, or in the evaluation of Deshaun by some of these guys. For example, one executive said, quote, "The Buffalo game won me over." It's a game where he, Sando points out they came back from a 16-0 deficit to beat the Bills in the playoffs. Watson gets everyone to believe in the face of certain peril. He makes the plays he needs to. This year will be a good test for him with a new cast.
That guy, who's that? That guy sounds more like a sports writer than an actual. Yeah. What the hell is that guy? Gets everyone to believe in the face of certain peril.
Well, we know that
good
some of these. So we know, depending on how good an executive he is, he may be angling for the next big gig. You know what I mean?
He's trying to get a job at The Athletic.
Yeah.
I think you should hire.
Right. Sando, can you put in a good word for me? That was the next quote. Here's what a personnel. Well, here's one stat that Sando points out. Led by Watson, the 2019 Texans were the only team to finish 500 or better, while ranking 20th or lower in defensive EPA, which is expected points average. I forget what the A stands for, but it's an efficiency metric. Houston was still 10-6 despite being in the bottom third of the league in really almost every defensive category.
And I think this is something that even when personnel types and team executives start saying things like gets everyone to believe, that's not typically like the kind of verbiage that they use, because they want to be more about the numbers and more about the hard defined things versus like the, hey, the Tim Tebow argument of like, hey, he's just a winner.
Yeah, the touchy-feely stuff.
But there is, you can document that with Deshaun in terms of his fourth quarter comebacks and how they do, how the Texans do in close games, all of those things. There's validation, like statistical validation, to Deshaun just flat out getting it done in the fourth quarter. And there aren't a whole lot of guys that can do that. And it's always hard, you know, with, like, say, Matt Stafford. Matt Stafford's never had a genuinely good supporting cast. He's had one of the best wide receivers in the NFL, but he never had a genuinely good supporting staff. But I don't think Matt Stafford, even though he's got a better arm than Deshaun Watson, I don't think Matt Stafford would be able to pull off a lot of the same things that Deshaun Watson is able to pull off right now.
Yep.
And Deshaun's going to continue to improve as a passer.
No doubt. Okay, so here's another quote. This is a personnel director. I look at the way the team wins. Is it true complementary ball? Is it heavy run game? Does the quarterback rely on play action? Is it stingy defense that allows him to have additional possessions? And then look at their supporting cast. When I think of the ones, meaning the tier ones, I can put you into any roster, and I know you're going to have a high level of success. I think with Deshaun Watson, there's a lot of he wins in spite of his supporting cast.
Yeah, and I think that's what you have to look at with quarterbacks, because we know that quarterback win-loss record doesn't tell the whole story by a long shot. But ask yourself, how often do the genuinely good quarterbacks have a 3-13 season or a 4-12 season? It's pretty uncommon.
Right.
Right? And I'd have a hard time seeing a Deshaun Watson-led team, no matter what the actual roster looks like. And that defense was in rough shape in the second half of last season. And you think about the guys that they just added on as the season went along. And yet, you win as many games as you did. That's what happens when you have a really good quarterback, a top-tier quarterback.
Yeah, I think his floor is too high. I think Deshaun, this is going to sound weird because he does take some chances. He's too careful to ever be the quarterback of a mediocre record team. Like, but you know, when you say that, Seth,
okay.
when you say that, I'm trying to rack my brain going, okay, who are some quarterbacks who quarterback team? Brett Favre was on 4-12 teams a couple of times in Green Bay. But Brett Favre can be super careless, and that's what'll do a team. That's when a great quarterback will do a team in, when the worst page of his book is one where he's just like making the, like, what are you seeing? What are you doing? Why are you throwing that?
Yeah, there was no
football
game management to Brett Favre.
Right.
Brett Favre was just all go all the time.
Right.
Where, and I don't want to over.
There aren't many examples.
Like, I don't want to insult Brett Favre or anything. Like, he knew how to preserve a lead in the fourth quarter and everything.
Yeah.
But he just, there was a part of a risk-taking mentality that just wasn't there.
Here's another one. This is from a defensive coordinator. This is on Deshaun Watson. playing him, you fear him running, but you don't fear him as a passer. And his running, you don't fear him as a passer. His running was not like Lamar Jackson. It was drop back, not there, take off and run. We never thought he was going to dice us up for 300 yards. I look at ones, meaning tier one guys, as guys that you feel like, we better have some bleep for this guy. We'd better manipulate our coverages. We'd better do this. We'd better do that. I don't know that I totally agree with that assessment, Seth.
Well, and again, this is where it's tough when you're evaluating an NFL player, because over the course of a 16-game season, there's a whole lot of variation. And I think you could look at a few games of Deshaun's last year and say, well, yeah, he hasn't really developed as a passer. I think there are other games where he did some really high-level stuff. And again, it was him learning lessons along the way, him reading coverages. One coach cited it was a play versus Baltimore, and I know which one he's talking about here. Watson recognized the coverage, dropped down, threw under an oncoming rusher instead of throwing over the top, which would have risked a pick six interception. That was one of the adjustments he made, even though that Baltimore game obviously wasn't a good one. One of the adjustments he made this season was he started all of a sudden feeling the blitz a lot more. He started feeling and understanding and recognizing pre-snap when there was going to be a situation. And I think one thing that people don't mention, or at least none of these quotes in here mention, was one of the big steps forward Deshaun made last year was in understanding pass protection better. With this Bill O'Brien offense, one of the things they aspire to do is for the quarterback to have an answer for any blitz, to have an answer for any coverage he might see. And a whole lot of that has to do with, all right, either I'm going to have to get rid of the ball really quickly because we've got a blitz coming and I'm going to do that and I know who's going to be open most likely. It might only be one or two reads. Or, and this is where it gets to be a real true chess match, and this is what Tom Brady's so good at, is, okay, I recognize what blitz is coming. I'm going to adjust the protection and my routes to dial up the perfect play versus that blitz. And we're actually going to go deep versus this blitz. Yeah. And we're going to pull it off. And Deshaun started building on that as the season went along. It's going to be – this is the big year for where he could take that really next step forward, where he's playing chess instead of checkers. And I think depending on which game some of these coaches and executives watch, they might not have seen that because it was something that he added on as the season went along.
Does the fact that DeAndre Hopkins isn't here anymore, and I'm not justifying the Hopkins trade by asking this, does the fact that he's not here anymore hasten that development that you're talking about now, whereas sometimes last year where it came time to look at the protections, crucial situations, things like that, that there may have been something in the back of Deshaun's mind where he goes, well, I'm just going to throw it in Hop's direction when in doubt, kind of thing.
And I think it's twofold, because you're right, it's hard to talk about this without people thinking that you're saying it was cool to get rid of DeAndre for really what amounted to a third-round pick
by the
time you factor the Johnson pick into it and everything.
That's right.
I think there's two things to that. One is there's the very simple side of, okay, yeah, he won't have his security blanket. Think back to when Eli Manning lost Jeremy Shockey, where it actually ultimately ended up being good for him, because Shockey was a pain in the ass, too. Shockey demanded the ball. He wasn't like DeAndre, who was pretty cool with Will Fuller getting looks and everything. But it made Eli a better quarterback because he was going to distribute it better. But I think more importantly, if you think about last year and think about the various receivers that Deshaun would have had as an option other than DeAndre Hopkins, it's real hard to be that kind of quarterback, that kind of guy that, like, oh, knows where all his receivers are and can adjust to the coverage, when guys like Kiki QT aren't even running the right routes.
Yeah, true.
You know, like, how do you become that guy? You want him to be Tom Brady, but without a Julian Edelman or a Wes Welker? You know, like, okay, great, be a Tom Brady, but the guy I want to throw to is on the other side of the field right now. And that's what they're hoping. Whether DeAndre was here or not, I think the addition of Randall Cobb and Brandon Cooks, and for the love of everything merciful, please, Will Fuller staying healthy for at least 12 or 13 games.
Yeah.
I think just actually knowing where guys are going to be and trusting they'll be where they're supposed to be could be the even bigger effect. Is just whether, and you could have done that. That's where I get angry. It's like, yeah, and you could have had Randall Cobb and Brandon Cooks as well as DeAndre Hopkins.
You could have.
Yeah.
Seth, did you see Will Fuller cut his dreads? There were pictures.
No.
Yeah, pictures. There were pictures circulating on the Texans' Twitter account yesterday. They were doing a lot of their green screen stuff yesterday. you know, yeah. for like the in-stadium videos.
The little GIFs they do and everything.
Yeah. You know, the little, the funny little things they do. And there was a picture of Will Fuller. I'm like, I don't think he has dreads anymore. I think he cut them. Yeah.
I wonder if he donated them to anybody. You know what he should do? He should save those locks of his. And after the season, if he has this bust-out season and the Texans do really well, he should use them to stuff a pillow and sell the
auction
pillow
it
for
off.
Charity. Yeah. You could sleep on Will Fuller's dreadlocks.
I wish he'd give them to me. As a fellow Notre Dame alum, like, you know, hook a brother up. Like, when Anthony Weaver was a player.
That's a good point.
And I used to do weekly radio with him on my other station. Weaver still had a hookup for Notre Dame equipment back with the school. Like, he still kept in touch with the equipment manager. And to this day, I still have some kick-ass Notre Dame gear from Anthony Weaver. Fuller needs to step his fellow alumni game up and give me his dreadlocks.
I'll never forget Anthony Weaver, speaking of gear, in his transition to becoming a Houstonian. One of the biggest steps for him was understanding the difference between high-tech fabrics like dry fit stuff and like the old school cotton. Because think about Weaver. Weaver grew up in upstate New York.
Yeah.
Then he went and played at Notre Dame.
And
then he played at Baltimore for the Ravens after that. So he'd always played in northern climates. And he showed up, and we're doing our off-season conditioning, and Weave's out there in, you know, heavy cotton, his gray cotton shorts and t-shirt and everything. Like, dude, what the hell are you doing? This is a miserable existence. You got to get with the program.
Well, he's one of the coaches that has the most gear on. Like, he has the towel around his neck, the long sleeves, the long pants, and the bucket hat at practice. He's keeping all that heat in.
The defensive line coach that was here when J.J. was a rookie, he was a former NFL player. For the life of me, I can't think of his name.
Is that Kolar?
Yeah, Kolar. Bill Kolar. Kolar was also – he was one of those guys, too, that would wear sweats all the time, no matter what. They just like to sweat.
Yeah.
But he was a skinnier guy. Weave's a more muscular, built-up dude.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to talk to Anthony about that. Like, now that he's a decision maker, now that he's actually calling the shots, we can't risk his electrolyte situation.
No.
He got some kind of – you know, if he's a little deficient in sodium or something and his brain, his synapses aren't firing right, we gotta get on top of that. Maybe back off on the heavy sweating, Weaver.
He just turned 40 earlier this week. That should be a wake-up call for things like that. You know, when that first digit changes, Seth, you got to start reevaluating some things. Another quote here on Deshaun Watson, back to the Mike Sando article. This is another evaluator. This is a GM where the Buffalo game played a huge role in his evaluation. He said, Deshaun shredded New England on that Sunday night game, which is true, he did. In the playoffs, Buffalo's defense was playing lights out with a great game plan. But really talented players at some point figure some things out along the way, and Watson started finding some things. I don't think there were a lot of quarterbacks down 16-0 the way Buffalo's defense was playing that would have brought that team back. And Seth, not only did, if you go back and look at the numbers, did he bring the team back, I think he had one incompletion through like the last quarter and a half of the game. He was like 12 of his last 13 or something like that.
Yeah.
And the plays that made that game were not things that Bill O'Brien dialed up. I guess maybe the run play was something he dialed up, but Deshaun getting into the end zone was all Deshaun. Like, the play was an effective play. That was a play where he had Cullen Gillespie pulling as a fullback, hitting a block downfield. Well-designed play for the first 15 yards, and then the last 5 yards were just Deshaun Watson, heart and soul, getting into the end zone. The play that made the game and set up the winning field goal, that was all Deshaun, and Deshaun probably misread some things to put himself in that position in the first place, right?
Yeah,
with the blitz, you know, with the blitz coming off the edge and so forth.
I think that one thing that Deshaun got better at too as the season went along, because you remember one of my initial complaints early in the season was I just wasn't buying his fakes a lot of time in the backfield. When it came to the play action and using the zone read and everything, it was too predictable. I tried to put myself in the situation as a defensive end of reading, okay, what's coming here? Am I reading the backfield action? Do I know whether it's a pass or a run? All that. It was a little too predictable and easy to read last year, in 2018, and on into 2019. He got a lot better at it as the season went along, because at one point I thought he was still being sloppy with it, and what I realized was, nah, he's gaming it a little bit. Like, sometimes he's making it look like a lazy handoff, and then using that to set up a lazy fake later in the game, like a fake lazy fake,
right.
If that makes sense.
Yep.
Just kind of the, you know, offensive linemen do this with dummy calls, kind of stuff to try to throw a little wrinkle into whatever the defense is starting to pick up on. And I think he got a feel for the finer aspects of some of the bluff game there this year.
The respect level for Deshaun, I think, Seth, seems to be slightly higher with these evaluators who have him in tier one, fifth overall, than it is with his fellow players. The NFL Top 100, as you and I talked about yesterday, came to its completion on Wednesday night. Deshaun made a big leap up this year. I think he was 50 last year. He's up to 20 this year. He's the seventh best quarterback according to his peers. And when we say peers, we found out yesterday from Wade Smith, because you and I have wondered this forever, who are the players that are voting on this? As it turns out, at least if the MO is still in place that was when Wade was a Pro Bowler, is that it's the Pro Bowlers that vote on this thing literally at the Pro Bowl, which would explain why so many Ravens did so well in the voting this year, including Lamar Jackson being the number one overall player, because the Ravens didn't make the Super Bowl, and they had 12 players at the Pro Bowl this year. So not only did they have their own votes, but they probably got to lobby a bunch of guys to put Ravens in there in all these spots. But Seth, my question to you is this. If you're a player like Deshaun, or even you as a former player when you were a player, what's more important to you, or either really important to you, the respect of your peers or the respect of coaches and evaluators around the league?
I guess let me try to put myself in that situation, because it's all dumb. It's all so stupid.
But it matters to these guys. Mahomes was tweeting about it yesterday when I joked that he wouldn't do that.
No. And I used to, like, intellectually, I know that it's dumb. But as a player, you do get wrapped up in this.
Yeah.
And I think for me with the Pro Bowl, I think when it came to the Pro Bowl vote, I think it was always the coach's vote that I would have cared about the most, because I know those guys are actually paying attention. Mm-hmm. They don't see everybody every year, you know, because you can't game plan for everybody every year. You're focused in on your several opponents that you have. But I think the coaches, I just always assumed that they would be the most unbiased in doing it and try to give an accurate read of it. Where with the players, I was in those meetings. I know how the Pro Bowl voting goes, and I know how much of it is like, look, if this veteran guy on the team, if this veteran leader on defense has a buddy or a guy that he thinks is a really good player on another team, that's who this team's going to, that's who we're going to vote for.
Yeah.
And that's how it is. Like, I don't want to even say a popularity contest. It's almost more at times like a combination of talent and who's plugged in the most. So I just took all of those results with a grain of salt.
You're a player whose playing career did not overlap with social media. Do you think stuff like the NFL Top 100 and in turn the respect of players, where they prop each other up on social media, they're retweeted, they're congratulating, way to go, bro, this and that, do you think the adulation of the players themselves, of their peers, matters more to current-day players than maybe players of your era?
Maybe. I don't know. I get people, like human beings in general, have always been desperately insecure.
Without
about,
sounding like
any...
an old guy saying, of course, kids these days, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you know,
Okay, Sean, you know why these questions make me uncomfortable? Because...
Wow.
Because it presumes that, like, all NFL players feel the exact same about everything.
Right, right.
It's like, hey, Seth, how do Americans feel about Trump? Like, well, that's a simple answer.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
There tends to be a lot of wide variety
of
things. So I guess I have a hard time with the questions about, like, okay, there's a broad cross-section, and some guys are desperate, like, okay, how does Kevin Durant feel about criticism compared to, say, like, I don't know, how does Kawhi Leonard feel about criticism?
I don't feel uncomfortable saying I think it matters more to this generation of players than it matters ultimately to everybody the same way. Like, I definitely think it matters more to this era of players. In large part because it didn't really exist back then. Like, it couldn't have, you know, that type of adulation couldn't have really mattered because it was unavailable at that time. And maybe when I say it matters more, you go, okay, well, it matters more, duh, because there was no social media back then. I would say it matters. If you're asking me to categorize, I would say it matters quite a bit to a lot of them, you know?
Yeah, and then some of them don't have social media at all, or just flat out don't care about it.
Right.
I guess, like, I don't, it's like, whenever you're up for any award, there's always, I think with a lot of people, there's a feeling of, like, I don't even really care about this, and then all of a sudden you're nominated, and you're like,
and
I find myself very invested in this, yeah.
Then when you don't get it, you're pissed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, a reminder, Jack Easterby, Bill O'Brien, actually, I'll flip it, Bill O'Brien, then Jack Easterby, today at 11 a.m. They're first press conferences of training camp. We'll carry him live here on Sports Radio 610. Speaking of screaming and maybe sounding like old guys, there's a lot of screaming about Dusty Baker not calling for a bunt on Wednesday. Proof, maybe, that anybody doing that is basically Grandpa Simpson screaming at a cloud. We'll have that for you next.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.